May it please the court, my name is Lawrence Kaplan. I represent a class of claimant participants, individuals who participate in a group called the Carpenters Welfare Fund of Illinois. I represent approximately 2,500 individuals who have segregated accounts in this fund of 2,468,700 and so banked hours, 2,400,000 hours approximately. These are banked hours, or what? Under
I'm
the
sorry. How many hours?
2,468,000. In July 31, 1994, these were worth $7,800,000 approximately. Their current value, based on the investment history of the fund, is $12,340,000. Now, I raise these numbers because if you take an average of $500 per month per family coverage to use this money, and you divide it by approximately 2,500 participants, it would buy 24,000 months of coverage under conventional health coverage. This case comes from the Middle District of Illinois. The case was bumped on a motion to dismiss, whereby Judge Scott held that my client did not have a colorable claim under ERISA, that in fact they were not participants as defined by ERISA. And as we know, that you must be a participant in order to bring an action under the ERISA statute. In fact, we believe that there are at least three bases for standing in this particular case. First and foremost, the plan itself provides for participant standing within the plan document. It defines participant as a variety of people, including ineligible participants. Our people are ineligible participants because they met but no longer continue to meet the requirements of eligibility under the plan. The district court...
Where does it say ineligible participants?
It's in it's a definition 2.1X in the appendix. One moment, please. On page 104 of the appendix, it says, participant means all eligible participants, ineligible participants, retired participants, and surviving spouses. And then ineligible participant on the same page under subsection V, this is 2.1V, says ineligible participant means a former eligible participant who had met but no longer continues to meet the eligibility requirements of the plan as set forth in section 3.1 or 4.1. The district court said, well, because it refers to 3.1 or 4.1, ineligible participant only means those individuals who no longer meet the hour requirement, and so therefore this couldn't possibly mean other ineligible participants, such as the individuals that I represent. It doesn't make any sense in the context of the plan itself, because under section 4.3 of the plan document, it talks about covered employment and who and when you are no longer in covered employment, and it lists a variety of things. You're no longer covered because the plan terminates. You're no longer covered because you don't meet the same qualification we talked about before in section 4.1, the hours. You're not covered because you began a welfare freeze, an item that I won't get into, and because you go into military service, and because the union in which you were working at the time withdrew from the welfare plan. Well, it's hard for me to understand why it is possible to say that the definition of ineligible only refers to the hours requirement when someone goes into the military service, and you're saying this guy...
My problem with your case is not standing. It's the merits. your group left this plan. So your view is they took the hours with them when they left?
My group is that those hours were vested and they remain in the plan.
Well, where in ERISA can we get some clues as to whether hours are the sort of things that vest?
Well, from ERISA, you know, welfare plans obviously don't normally have vested hours, except in this particular case, we have testimony from the chief trustee in this case, who says that any time these individuals come back into covered employment, they have a right to claim their hours, and in fact, their history.
Well, but as you say, welfare plans unlike pension plans, don't involve vesting. If you're right, then what had been understanding about these things collapses. Now every welfare plan beneficiary will be arguing that his benefits vested.
I think there's a difference here, Your Honor, simply because these people had segregated accounts within this fund. It was their hour bank, and it was their benefits to claim. The only difference...
I know, but ordinarily, if you leave a company's employee, you leave everything behind you. Now, if it's a pension plan and your benefits are vested, you take them, in effect, with you.
The difference in this case, Your Honor, is this is not a single employer plan, and
difference that makes.
Well, it does, because the carpenters move in and out of they could move in and out of coverage in from Southern Illinois into the neighboring district council. They would get the benefit according to what our witness, our chief trustee, testified, not ours, but their chief trustee testified to. They would get the benefit of those hours. So in if that's true as to what he said, I can go back and clear in to the council and get all of my banked hours, then there are banked hours for my particular group to claim. So what he has said, at any time you come back in, you can get those hours. The district court said, well, you haven't done that, so you haven't get those hours. But when that right is extinguished by terminating the fund at this particular time, then you're going to be in a situation where that right has been extinguished. And under the Flanagan case that we cite, when those rights are extinguished, when I can no longer go back in and claim my hours, then I do have standing under ERISA. I'm sorry.
Bear with me briefly. 4.3 of the plan, the statewide fund plan.
Yes.
Provides for the termination of coverage, and 4.5 says what happens in a withdrawal. And one of the things it says in 4.5, if a union or district council decides to withdraw, notwithstanding any provision of the trust or eligibility to the contrary, past or current contributions received or eligibility prospectively accumulated to each and every employee who works for a contributing employer as a member under the jurisdiction and so on, shall forfeit and terminate all rights as an eligible participant in said fund, including accumulated eligibility, all benefits rights to earn for himself and dependents, and as of midnight of the 30th of the day following the effective day, accepting such self-contributions. Now, how does that square with your position?
Well, first of all, yeah, it does say that, and second of all, there's another element of standing that we have here. In 94, a motion was made by trustees to amend this trust. Illegally, trustees from our area were not permitted to vote. They were excluded from voting.
So you're saying this does not have a valid provision?
It's a valid provision, Your Honor, except that there's two qualifying events here. Number one, it is a valid. There isn't a rationality to it, because basically people can go out of the fund and come back in, and as long as there is a token representation by their union, maybe just one group of 100 people out of thousands, these people who go out and come back, they can claim their vested hours. But our people cannot. So there's a level
of...
Well,
that raises the statute of limitations issue, though.
Well, all right. Well, let's talk about that.
The fact that 6 or 7 years after that voting decision.
Well, a couple of things, Your Honor. First of all, I believe we're under the state statute of limitations, which is a 10-year statute. In 1994, we were excluded. The plan was violated. the Southern trustees who represented generally the participants that represent all participants, but generally the participants from Southern Illinois, were illegally excluded from voting. And they were not allowed to vote. They had the votes. That's one of the stipulated facts. They had the vote to amend the plan to transfer the benefits down. So there you have a contract violation.
Well, but this seems to me that that's the time to challenge this and get all this stuff ironed out before you actually withdraw and trigger this 4.5 section.
Well, the fact of the matter is you're talking about a bunch of lay people who were not represented, who the fund council had told, you can't vote, you cannot participate. Now the fund council in the year 2001 changes his opinion and says, okay, now we can amend the plan, and these other groups...
How does that bear on the statute of limitations?
Well, I think... Is there a tolling?
Lay people aren't subject to statute of limitations?
Oh, yes, sir. But I believe there's a 10-year statute, the state statute.
That's a different argument. I don't know what you... what mileage you get out of the fact these are lay people.
Well, I think there's a tolling aspect to it. If you're going to claim that there's a, that, you know, they should have done this. The fund representative, who happened to be the attorney, ruled or stated, "You do not have a right to vote." He was wrong. I believe there's, because the fund representative has made that statement, and that is in fact the act which occurred. Then there would be a tolling argument that would occur as a result of that, and that these people, because of that statement, relying on his statement, only to find later that that statement in 2001 has been changed, the rules of the game have been changed, I think there's a tolling aspect to the state's the fund's representation to the participants that they could not participate in that vote. Now, if you have a contract violation and you're within the 10-year statute, why don't you have the right to correct that? I mean, you can say, well, maybe they should have done it right away, but maybe they didn't understand the implications because they didn't understand it because the rules got changed in the year 2001.
Well, as soon as the vote was taken.
Pardon me?
The vote was taken and it came up tied, wasn't it?
Right.
And there was an arbitrator that's brought it. So they know right away when that arbitrator made a decision that didn't go.
Well, the arbitrator didn't have jurisdiction. I mean, he voted on a trust. He really didn't have jurisdiction. Under the law of this circuit and other circuits, he didn't have the right to vote. A group of trustees...
Why wasn't it challenged at that time?
They were out. Now, I mean, could they have brought a cause of action at that time? I guess they could have, but the assumption was that the ruling that they were given by the fund, was appropriate and that they did not have the right to vote at that time. They did not have the right, those trustees, it was, one, illegal to take funds out, and two, it was illegal for them to vote on an amendment to take votes out. Now, you couple this back with the idea that we have the chief trustee saying you can come back into the fund, you can collect your money at any time. Now, at this particular time, anytime you clear in, you can get those funds back. So something's there. We've got these other councils who want to split up this fund now, and they're going to move, quote, bank hours out of the fund to another unrelated fund. They're understanding that these are segregated vested benefits that these people have now and will move into these successor funds when they break up the fund. So you have a contract was violated. It's within the 10-year statute. You have the reliance on the fund representative who was the attorney who said you can't vote. So they relied on what he said. Now the rules have changed. Now they're saying we can break it up, we can transfer these hours, and in fact you can't, your case was different. I don't know if this is the 10-minute mark or the 15-minute mark. I was going to reserve.
Completely
time.
Off. You're completely
Pardon me?
Off. You're
at the 1-minute mark.
All right. Well, thank you. I think you understand.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kaplan. Mr. Casey?
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Bob Casey. I represent the Appellees Carpenters Welfare Fund of Illinois and its trustees. With me at council table is Mr. Peter Katsaris, who represents the same appellees plus Appellee Baum, but I will be presenting the argument today. Our primary position on appeal, and I will address some of the issues that Mr. Kaplan raised in his argument to the court, but our primary position on appeal is basically what Judge Bauer noted, which is the trial court got it right. There's Section 4.5 of the plan and Section 4.3 of the plan. And 4.3, which Mr. Kaplan cited, has any number of provisions in it that say when you lose eligibility. 4.3b says if you fail to continue to have enough hours under 3.1 and 4.1, you won't have eligibility for benefits. There's a separate provision, 4.3e, says that anybody whose union withdraws under 4.5 loses eligibility for benefits in the fund. Now, contrary to Mr. Kaplan's representation, there is nothing. Nowhere in the plan is there anything that says this is a pot of money. Come get the money. Mr. Rakow, when he testified at his deposition, which was not timely submitted to the district court below, but when he testified, he didn't say, you know, when you come back, you get a pot of money. That's not how welfare benefits work. It's not a pension plan. If they never come back into the fund, they get nothing from us. There's no eligibility for anything. And the 1982 example that Mr. Rakow was asked about was the example of a 1982 participant who left to go work in the St. Louis area. He returned after a 13-year absence. The trustees decided that he would be allowed to become eligible again for plan benefits upon payment of 200 hours of new contributions rather than 600 hours. And the initial eligibility rules of 4.1 say otherwise you need 600 hours when you come back in. That's all Mr. Rakow was responding to when he was asked
that question. Why was he allowed to get back in for 200 hours?
The trustees determined that he had established initial eligibility 13 years before, and therefore he didn't need a new 600 hours. He was allowed to participate again, but only after 200 more hours were...
But when he came back in, that did he then get access to this, to these banked hours?
I don't believe there's anything in the record or the decision that deals with banked hours in that case. That there was
What about Mr. Kaplan's argument? I didn't follow it, actually, but maybe you can clarify it, about how somehow you can take your hours to another carpenter's district or something. What's that about?
If I understand what Mr. Kaplan's saying, I'm not sure what it's about either, but I believe he said that because carpenters can move around the state and they can work for different employers who may be participating in different funds, that as long as you come back to an employer in this fund that the union has some presence in, you can then reclaim your hours here. That argument has no relevance to this case. Two points. One, the argument about them, carpenters are defined as participants by who they work for, rather than whether their union participates in the fund, wasn't raised until the post-judgment motions below. It was not timely raised. Secondly, in this case, we don't have a district council who maintained any presence in this fund. They withdrew under Section 4.5. The district court was correct. They have to get past Section 4.5 before we get to any of these issues, like statute of limitations, other merit issues, whether they were improperly prevented from voting in 1994. Those are issues which the district court did not decide.
But now if you leave one district, go to another, come back to your original district, and re-enroll, and so you're re-enrolled in the welfare plan, then and the welfare plan has a million banked hours or something, you would have access to them along with the other members? Is that
Mr. Rakow testified. That situation hasn't been put before the trustees, so I don't know what they would decide. If you use Mr. Milliman's example from 1995, 82 to 95, what would happen is he would come back in, and if there were at least 200 hours that could be credited to him, because either they were banked hours from somebody or because they were contributed, he would now become eligible for benefits. But all that means is he gets benefits from our fund.
But all that assumes is that the union itself had not withdrawn.
That's correct. Or else he's come back to work for a different employer whose union has not withdrawn.
Oh.
Because the money stays in the fund. The arbitrator Irving's decision...
When you say he'd have to pay 200 hours into the fund, you mean the monetary equivalent of it?
Correct. The employer would have to pay 200 hours of benefits on his behalf into the fund. There is nothing. This is not a breach of contract case. There is nothing in the plan that says you get to take the money with you and go buy insurance elsewhere. Reduced to its simplest effort, what they're trying to tell you is, you know, we had this money, we wanted to use it in 1994, but we also wanted to leave the fund. It's no different from somebody coming to the fund to say, I know I have 1,600 banked hours, it's worth X amount of money. You know, I want to stop being a carpenter and I want to go buy Blue Cross Blue Shield. It doesn't work that way.
You couldn't do this if it were a retirement fund, could you?
Pension fund is totally different. That's why the Flanagan case...
Well, the pension fund would prevent you doing shutting them off, but this would... Well, ERISA was planned for that, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. The Flanagan case, which they rely on heavily in their briefs, 2 points about that. One, that's a pension case.
Yeah.
It dealt with the rule of parity under pensions. There is no rule of parity in welfare benefit claims. And lastly, I've looked, I may have missed it, but as far as I can tell, Flanagan, which is a 1993 decision, was never cited, was never argued to the district court. They didn't make the argument there. They didn't make most of the arguments on a timely basis that they make before this court today, and we pointed that out in our briefs. What is undisputed for purposes of this court is that, according to their own complaint, paragraph 4 and paragraph 24 of the second amended complaint, their district council withdrew. Now, withdrawal is a special action. It has specific consequences. And the language that was quoted by Judge Bauer and Mr. Kaplan says what those consequences are. And those consequences are that all employees, and remember, these individuals back in 1994 were employees of contributing employers represented by the Southern District Council. Says all those employees sacrifice, they forfeit all their benefit rights, and the exact language is, quote, including all accumulated eligibility and all benefit rights. It couldn't be more clear. And that's what Judge Scott properly decided. Under this court's decision, including the Kamler case submitted as a supplemental authority last week by Mr. Kaplan, the inquiry ends there. The plan language is clear. If in 1994 they withdrew and they didn't have the right to take any money with them at that time, and they haven't come back into the fund, then where is their colorable claim to vested benefits? There isn't any. They clearly don't have current participant status. They don't even have ineligible participant status because what they are is former participants who withdrew. And 4.5 specifically provides they're out of luck. They get nothing. The district court properly recognized the Panaris decision and the fact that you don't need a lot to prove that you might have a colorable claim, but even that wasn't satisfied here. And the reason, again, is because of sections 4.5 of the plan. It's remarkable to me that in Mr. Kaplan's argument, as well as in their opening brief, they almost don't talk about 4.5 at all, when that is at the core of the district court's decision. What happened here is that in 1994, this district council and the employees they represented and the employers who employed them decided they want to set up their own fund. They knew what the withdrawal consequences were under Section 4.5 were, so they said, let's change the rules. Let's try to change the rules. It didn't work. Whether it was because they were improperly told they couldn't vote, we frankly think Mr. Baum's advice was proper, but whether it was right or wrong, they rolled the dice. And they said, you know, we're going to withdraw. We know what the consequences are. We're starting our own fund. And they hoped that their colleagues who deadlocked at the trustee level would win before the arbitrator. They lost the roll of the dice. Since 1994, they have not been participants in this fund. They
What was the question put to the arbitrator, the same as in our case? Or?
there were two questions put to the arbitrator. One was, should, to paraphrase, Section 4.5 of the plan be enforced against the withdrawing district council? And the arbitrator looked through, the opinion is in the appendix that was submitted to the court. The arbitrator looked at the history of the plan, looked at the fact that in other withdrawals, there had been no money that left the fund, and said the same rules should apply to the Southern Illinois District Council, even though the fund has more money now. Second question that the party submitted to the arbitrator jointly was, should 4.5 be amended? They gave it to the arbitrator. He said no and no, it shouldn't be. The arbitrator had the authority to make that decision. We don't really have to reach that issue here, but it's clear to me that he did, because first of all, the party voluntarily submitted it to him, and secondly, it has nothing to do with amending the trust document. The amendment proposed by the trustees was to amend the plan withdrawal rules, the penalty for withdrawal, not the trust document. If it's, and the rule, at least as I understand it, is that if it's an action that the trustees can take in the normal course, then it concerns the administration of the fund, and an appointed arbitrator can decide it. Well, if it wasn't an action the trustees could make in the first place, why was it proposed by the Southern Illinois group? It clearly was. The arbitrator decided those two questions against them.
Yeah, good question. I find the standing business very puzzling. They argue, your opponent argues, that they basically have vested benefits in this hours fund. Right or wrong, what's the standing problem? They're either right or wrong. If they have vested benefits, surely they have standing to sue for. Who else would have standing?
Well, the way I read Pinaris is to allege they have standing is they at least have to have a colorable claim, one that's not frivolous. And I think it's frivolous because of Section 4.5.
Is there any practical difference between saying that their claim is not valid and saying that they don't have standing?
It's kind of a merger.
If you say they have standing because they have a colorable claim, or let's assume they have a colorable claim, I think you're correct in the sense you'd still get the 4.5 and say, but you're out of luck.
Right.
Now, from, in terms of the Thomas Rakow deposition testimony, I would just point out to the court that the district court correctly concluded it wasn't timely submitted. And even if it was timely submitted, it's not relevant. with respect to one of the last points, I believe, made by Mr. Kaplan in his presentation to the court, which is that in the rules changed from 1994 to 2001, and that's when they finally figured out that they'd been jobbed back in 1994. A withdrawal from the fund is different from terminating the entire fund. A withdrawal is a specific action under 4.5. It occurred 7 years ago. The plan says what the consequences are. Termination is when the fund ceases to exist. Nobody's there. It's not like one union has withdrawn, set up its own fund. When you terminate the fund, you have to use the benefits in, or the contributions in the fund for the benefit of the existing participants. We don't believe we could even pay money to the St. Louis group, because they are not participants in the fund. That would violate ERISA. But if you get past the 2001 amendment, which is what Mr. Kaplan is arguing about, he says, you know, in 2001 they improperly amended the plan to allow this money to go to other funds that the settlers decided. Let's say you don't do that. Let's say you use the old termination language. The old termination language, which is in the supplement, says you terminate the fund, you run out the assets for the benefit of those currently eligible, or who then eligible. They don't meet that definition. A termination is substantively and very different from a withdrawal. The two are not equal. Is there any other questions? I'll answer.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Casey. Mr. Kaplan, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
To answer the question that I believe Judge Posner asked earlier, what I have said is that, first of all, there's a couple of points that are being made here. In 2001, the trustees voted to terminate the fund and push all these assets into three other council funds. Number one, it's not being reserved for any of the participants of the existing fund. They're just tossing the money in. And they may get some benefit as part of another group which already exists. And two of the councils, these already exist with all kinds of other employees who have never participated into the funds, and they're just throwing that money in there. That's number one. Number two, both of the councils that we know about, Chicago and Mid-Central, have both said that you can take your vested hours that you had in the prior fund and you can get credit for it in the new fund. So they too are making the point that these vested hours exist. They exist in the fund, the statewide fund, and they will exist in the successor fund. That's the point I was trying to make. Now, my time is over. I believe that we have the point that our contract was violated. We were not allowed to vote. We relied on the trustee, and that a different standard is being applied now. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you to both counsel. Next case for argument.